Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. It's May 29th, 2019. I am your host, Chris Martinson. We have many views at Peak Prosperity, but a central position is that the central banks are not your friends, and that they are instead stewards of a system of extraction and redistribution. They're not wealth creators, they're redistributors, right? So the central banks, they vigorously defend the practices of exponential expansion on a finite planet and assuring that wealth concentrates at the very tippy top of the social and political pyramids. But these central banks are also, drumroll please, staffed with humans, mere mortals, which means they suffer from the usual collection of human attributes that have run civilizations all throughout history into a variety of ditches. Hubris, tunnel vision, dogmatic theologies, and belief systems that do not align with the real world are working against our collective best interest today, just as certainly as they did for the Aztecs, for the Mayans, for the Romans, just for different sets of bad reasons, right? With respect to modern central banks, the easiest test to administer to detect just how close to the ditch we are is to look at the balance between how many monetary claims have been issued as compared to the real economy. How much money in debt has been emitted versus how fast the economy or global income has grown. Now there we see evidence, solid evidence, of the oldest of all banking mistakes being committed yet again. Let's look at it this way. Global debt, already staggering before the onset of the Great Recession in 2007, has grown by over $100 trillion, that's with a T, while the global economy has increased only $25 trillion. So that's a 4-to-1 increase of debt over income. The value of equities, which are also claims on that same GDP number, just like debt, equities have increased dramatically, hitting all-time new highs in both nominal terms and expressed as a percentage of global GDP. So what I'm saying here is the claims have exploded. The underlying economy has limped along. So what's next? Probably, you're a betting person, more of the same, right? More printing, more interventions, more attempts to keep the credit levels exploding even higher and faster than they already are, which is why today's guest is especially relevant. Neither you or I can do anything about how much currency the central banks decide to print up as they run their scheme off into probably the biggest monetary ditch in human history. But we can protect ourselves by stepping outside of their system into the world of real or hard assets. Today, we're speaking with Craig Hemke, a.k.a. Turd Ferguson, founder and proprietor of the precious metals blog, tfmetalsreport.com. Turd, or Craig, was a licensed securities professional for nearly 20 years before leaving the profession in 2008, disillusioned perhaps, to become a self-described serial entrepreneur. And since then, he's become one of the more popular and for sure one of the most colorful voices advocating for gold and silver ownership by the average investor. Every month, hundreds of thousands of readers visit TF Metals Report eager for his analysis, as well as very specific short-term price predictions for where the metals are headed. Hey, it's been entirely too long since we've had him on. Craig, welcome to the show.
Chris, what a pleasure. I always tell folks, when they ask me who the smartest person I know is, I say it's Chris Martinson. So I say that. I'm not kidding. That's what I always say. So it's always a pleasure to visit with you. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, just a real pleasure, real honor to have you on. So, Craig, before I hit the record button, you and I are having this rolling conversation. So as succinctly as you can, how would you describe this particular era that we're in terms of what it means for the average investor?
Well, I think in your opening monologue there, you covered a lot of bases, and I think you succinctly described the problem, even in a broad sense. I think that the biggest challenge for the average investor is that kind of, I don't want to call it contrarian, maybe it's more out of the box, it's individualistic thinking rather than herd thinking. That's very difficult for people to do, especially when we're discussing subjects that have not occurred in people's lifetimes. You know, I always remember, say, for example, my grandparents who lived through the Great Depression. You know, they had canned goods, you know, all these things stored in their basement. Even when I was, you know, a teenager in the 80s, they still had canned goods in their basement. And I would, and I remember talking to my grandparents at the time, long since passed away, you know, and that was the refrain. Well, you know, once you live through the reset or through a depression, you know, it kind of changes you, it affects you. Mm-hmm. And it impacts how you plan and prepare going forward. Well, see, nobody alive today has lived through and therefore can anticipate what is coming. That's a very difficult step for a human, you know, a human mind to make. You know, you listen to all the talking heads on CNBC and Bloomberg and every place else, your stockbroker, you name it. And the only system they have ever known is this dollar reserve system, giving the U.S. this, you know, exorbitant privilege, as Secretary Connolly called it. And that has been in place since Bretton Woods, 1945. So really, the, I mean, you got what, an octogenarian plus, you know, is the only people that are still alive today that remember a time when the dollar wasn't the central foundation of the world monetary system. But that's a transient privilege. I mean, that is, I mean, anybody can trace that history back. You know, it was the pound sterling before it was the U.S. dollar. And so it's very difficult for people to, if they don't have a history that they can recall, to then project forward into, you know, what's coming next. And I think that's the biggest problem facing people, really, particularly since 2008 or 9, when the death bells, you know, were rung for this system. We've been, the banks have been zombies. The central bankers have propped it up through all of this money issuance and now negative interest rates and bail-ins and all the other stuff they've got planned for the next crisis. But yet nobody can really, it's very difficult for people to see then coming and to project where the system, you know, flips back to. And so I think that's a, that's human nature. It's a kind of a cognitive dissonance that people have to overcome. But I think that's a, what you do a great job of, and that's what I try to keep people focused on too.
Well, very well said. You know, one of my catchphrases is the next 20 years is going to be completely unlike the last 20 years. And what that's really speaking to is this idea that as humans, it's very typically normal, ordinary, I do it, everybody does it, to base what the future is going to be based on what just happened, right? We're right. All expecting the road to continue straight. And the trouble comes when there's a sharp corner in the road, right? Because it's obviously, you know, very hard to detect those in advance. And we're unprepared for them. And so I think a lot of people have gotten complacent and grown into this idea that what the central bank started to undertake in a coordinated fashion in 2007 and 8, when they started doing this quantitative easing or monetary printing or balance sheet expansion, whatever your favorite term is. But people in the last, you know, what is that now, 11 years have said, well, I guess that's how things are now. That's the road. The road is straight in this direction. We can count on the central banks always doing that. And what I find unique at this point in time is that for that to have worked, it required all the central banks to have been in unified behavior sets, right? Bank of Japan had to be doing it along with the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, the minor central banks of Australia and Canada, but also the People's Bank of China, right? So as long as they were all kind of doing the same thing, it worked. But now we're starting to see some ruptures in that. You mentioned the dollar reserve system, so I'm going to jump ahead a few questions, get into that, because there's some exciting stuff happening, or interesting, when we see that how the United States has been using the dollar as a club and threatening Europe. You know, we're going to lock you out of the U.S. banking system, and threatening, obviously already having SWIFT challenged Russia, putting economic sanctions dollar-based on Iran, and then also threatening China with the same stuff. How do you see that potentially shaping the future?
Well, there's no question. Those are the flailing, you know, threats of a dying regime, in a sense, because you're just so desperate to keep everybody in line that, you know, the hubris of all this, you know, it's not necessarily financial or monetary terrorism, but it's definitely bullying. And, you know, all the way down to the individual level, you get bullied long enough, you finally say, well, I'm sick of this crap, right? I'm gonna search out something else. I think when the system really died back in 2008, I think the dollar creditor nations, you know, those countries that have been accepting dollars for goods, you know, whether it's Saudi Arabia, you know, and the Gulf states, you know, is accepting dollars for oil under the petrodollar system, or whether it's the Chinese and all of the BRICS countries that have been accepting dollars for goods under, you know, and I think that's all kind of been set up that way as well, deliberately. I think all those countries with dollar reserves looked around and went, oh, wait a second here, hold on just a minute. There's some problems with this. And as you mentioned, in the effort since, we're now down to what, you get a 25 cents worth of growth for every new dollar of debt. So these problems are becoming even more apparent. But I think in 2008, a lot of those creditor nations were caught somewhat flat-footed, you know, mm-hmm. and didn't realize how hostage they were, how tied they were to the system. And, you know, if you and I can see this, and if you and I can discuss this, and have been discussing it for years, well, I'm pretty sure that the smart people in these other countries can see it coming as well. And so they've been laying a foundation slowly, gradually, over the last 10 or 11, you know, intervening years since the financial crisis, so that at a point maybe of their choosing in the future, they'll begin to offer an alternative that doesn't necessarily replace the dollar as the reserve, but it supplants it as being the sole reserve. And now you start getting into a system where, oh, wait a second, we've got way more supply of dollars than we have demand for dollars. And that then becomes a real problem for the U.S. and for the U.S., you know, current monetary system. Because anybody that's taken Econ 101, right, you know, if supply increases while demand falls for any good, then the value, the price, if you will, of that good falls. Now, you just got way more supply than you have demand, right? Excess supply. And so that's where we're headed with dollars as well. And that is going to cause massive problems, particularly here in the U.S., you know, where we have this dollar system. Look, all of this, it may sound, like I said, to some folks that haven't really thought this through, they think, well, that's crazy. That, you know, that hasn't ever happened in my lifetime, so therefore it means it's never going to. No, I'm sorry. We're not going to be afforded that luxury. We are now, that, as you pointed out, again, these numbers, 25 cents of growth for every dollar of new debt. That is, again, that's that exponential end of the system where things get out of control. You can't create growth and dollars fast enough to service the rapid growth of all the existing debt. That's what the Fed has figured out. They've been lying to us now for 10 years about how they've got it under control. You know, they were going to expand the balance sheet. I remember the balance sheet was going to be normalized, giving everybody, leading everybody to believe that, oh, they're going to go back to a trillion or a trillion and a half dollar balance sheet. Well, no, actually, they told us now in March that they're going back to 3.7. That's as low as they can go. People are figuring out that the tide, if you will, is starting to now finally go out here in 2019. And people are figuring out that, wait a second, you know, there are some problems here. They don't have it under control. They've been flying by the seats of their pants. This has been one big experiment for the last 10 or 11 years. And I think that begins to accelerate this process as well. We'll see that. And I know we'll talk about gold and silver eventually, but we'll see that now beginning now to play out in precious metal prices too.
And I really do want to get to this idea of this monetary experiment as a way of setting this all up, because gold and silver are now a subset of this larger conversation. This is, without question, as you said, the largest monetary experiment. And it's, and that monetary experiment, because money is a social contract more than it is anything else. It's not real. It's an agreement we hold. It's also a social experiment. We're starting to see that social experiment fray, particularly in places that have more of a cultural history of being a little bit more alert, being a little bit more talkative and inquisitive, and also a little bit more rebellious, and that would be Europe, right? So we see the yellow vests protesting those mm-hmm. neoliberal policies, which is a fancy phrase for saying, we're going to vacuum up all your money and give it to a very tiny elite, which they're going to hide in offshore accounts, right? They know no nations, they care not for your culture, they're just all about the money, right? And we're seeing that populism rise as well in Italy, and it's emergent in Spain. So Europe's waking up to this whole thing. I think that it's going to be very hard for the European Central Bank to ride out again at some point and say, listen, it's an awkward moment, but we're just going to have to make the rich even richer here for a little bit longer because right. stocks went down a little bit in price. You know, that's getting to be a harder argument. They're working very, very hard in the United States to keep us dumbed down, distracted, and otherwise off the scent of that particular story. But more people are coming to it. And really, it's that large experiment. They're so Let me test what you think. So what I think is that, you know, I've got this little meme running on Twitter, which I'm sure you've seen. I pump it out. It's like, you know, I think that the markets now, equity markets in particular, are government operated utilities. I think that they're intervened in pretty regularly by, call it what you will, the plunge protection team or PPT, by some combination of state and private actors. Maybe it's Citadel with Bernanke sitting in there, plus the PPT, plus the Federal Reserve. I don't know. But at any rate, they're using the markets as a means of conveying a set of signals, and they are so afraid of allowing it to go backwards that that's what has my attention, is just how desperately afraid they are of seeing equity prices do what they've done through all of history, which is sometimes go up, sometimes go down.
Right.
So they're so afraid of the down now. How do you interpret that? Do you agree with that? And if so, how do you interpret that fear?
Well, they can't afford the down. I mean, that's all part of where we are now in the cycle and the process. Like I said, it's spiraling so quickly and exponentially, and, you know, I think of it almost like parabolic growth of debt, that you can't afford a deflation, and a stock market crash would be a deflation, because that just makes a situation even worse. You mentioned the plunge protection team, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. I mean, anybody can Google that term, see what we're talking about. And before you think, oh, you can't manipulate the stock market, how are you going to buy, you know, $1 trillion worth of Apple, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's not, that betrays an understanding of how markets operate in 2019 on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. Anywhere from 80 to 90% of the trading volume every day is high frequency trading computers, trading, swapping positions at the speed of light, really trying to nick each other for fractions of a penny. And so when the trading is done by computer, then once you figure that out, then you can influence the trading by influencing the computers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you then can further break that down and say, well, okay, the buy decisions that are built into these computer programs that run everything are taking their cues largely from just a couple of different inputs, well, then you can influence and, you know, reverse the market, drive the market higher, whatever, just simply by affecting a few inputs. Does that all make sense? You see where I'm going with this? You don't have to, it doesn't take trillions and trillions of dollars. You're not in there buying Apple and Microsoft and Google directly. You affect the inputs that drive the computers, and then all of the speculator money, hedge fund money, all the stuff out that's out there, these high frequency trading money, they take the lead following those inputs. So that's how you can get. I mean, you think about how where we were on Christmas Eve last year, when the stock market was collapsing. Christmas Eve, we were down 600 some odd points on a, you know, the holiday shortened session. And news hits during that day that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has called the heads of the five banks and then is calling together, you know, the Working Group on Financial Markets for an emergency meeting on Christmas Eve night. And then lo and behold, the very next day of trading, December 26, we go up 1,100 points. And it was basically straight up at a 45-degree angle, which is another sign, for about the next 90 days. And now we appear to maybe have plateaued and double-topped. There's a reason why then this is taking place. And you touched on it. This equity market, yeah, public utility is an interesting way to put it, but they cannot afford a deflationary, you know, another 50% market collapse like we saw in 2001 and 2008. Why? Because of the demographics, you know, the baby boomers and all these people, that their retirement savings are either in the few remaining defined benefit plans that are in, you know, in public corporations. There's certainly a whole bunch of defined benefit plans on the public side of things, on the government side, teachers, state employees, local municipal employees, all those folks. And all of those plans are grossly underfunded through years of mismanagement and from not being funded on the front end with enough money, you know, to cover all these promises on the back end, kind of like Social Security on, you know, on a smaller scale, each of these individual plans. And so they cannot afford to allow the stock market to go down. Traditional pension plans that for decades only invested in investment grade fixed income securities because they had to invest conservatively. Well, the Fed and the central bankers have wrecked that by driving interest rates down to, you know, 0 and 1% and even negative. And so these traditional pension plans have had to go out and take more and more risk in shorting the VIX, you know, all these crazy things that they're doing, trying to find yield. It cannot, they just simply, they know they can't afford a contraction. And that's just on that side. The individual wealth of, again, the baby boomers that are, you know, in their peak earning years and beyond, trying to save money in defined contribution plans like 401ks and IRAs. They can't afford it, you know, the old saw about going from a 401k to a 201k. They can't afford it either. And so again, to get to your point, yeah, that's where all of these pieces fit. Can they overcome that and keep the stock market going up by just printing enough money, keeping, you know, a flush amount of liquidity in there and affecting those inputs? Well, I wouldn't bet against them. They've been successful so far, but it's everybody else. You know, the other 90% of the U.S. population, speaking specifically the U.S. that doesn't have equity exposure, you know, the 60% of the U.S. population that doesn't even have $500 in savings, the 40% of the population that doesn't even have enough money that if they can't get a new set of tires, they can't afford any emergency expenses. It's those people that have just been crushed through 45 years of untethered fiat currency, untethered to any sound money. You know, you just print as much as you want. And it is those folks that, as this worsens, it'll be interesting to see how they respond.
Well, indeed, and very well said, all of that. And I believe there's, you know, powerful reasons, pensions among them, that to need to keep the whole thing going. But as they continue to pump and try and keep the whole thing going, what they've been hoping for, fingers double crossed behind their backs, is that we would get to high productivity, right, native organic economic growth, which hasn't happened because guess what? Incentives and human behavior are really closely linked. And if you can incentivize a company to basically take no risk by buying back its shares through financial engineering and achieve the same returns as they could by taking lots of risk, by having to build new property, plant, equipment, you know, and all of that, what are they going to do? Well, I'll take the same returns for no risk rather than all that hard work. And so that's what they've done. And so now here we are with like records amount of corporate debt and enormous amounts of stock buybacks fueling this whole thing. And that's the system that of course, if the Federal Reserve was staffed with intelligent humans who were more broadly educated than just around that narrow, I have a PhD in economics from Princeton, right? If they had that broader view, they would understand that you can't run an emergency measure for 10 years, which has powerful incentives, without warping the system. So here we are. They're afraid of having it fall. And I want to get your views now. If we rewind the clock a bit, 2011, remember, so we had gold and silver spiking, but we also had oil spiking. We also had grains. We had all sorts of commodities, right? So everything, everything's spiking. And the Federal Reserve announces, oh my God, but things aren't quite where we need them to be. We had a little stock market hiccup. They freaked out 2011 again. So they said QE3. This is the largest announcement of monetary printing in human history. $85 billion a month starting immediately. And what happened was within 2 weeks of that, we ticked the high mark in all sorts of commodities, grains, metals, oil, you name it, right? And they all started to collapse at that point in time. Also, a little known fact for most people is that the New York Federal Reserve, here's a fun fact, I love coincidences, they also had moved their trading desks from New York to Aurora, Illinois. Why? Well, it's a safe inland place, safe from storms, but also happens to be magically right next to the server farms for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So make of that what you will. How do you interpret commodities being absolutely hammered during probably the most aggressive money printing the world has ever seen?
Oh boy, I could talk on that one for quite a long time, but I don't want to inflict that on everybody listening. Let me just take one little, I guess, part of that, and at least and kind of, I can't lay it all at the feet of the dollar, but let's just go in that direction as part of the answer. You know, the way the dollar is currently measured, everybody has seen, you know, the purchasing power of the dollar and how it's declined since 1913 when the Federal Reserve System was initially enacted and approved. But over the past several years, it's been perceived to be stronger because the dollar is measured against all of the other fiat currencies out there. And so it becomes like a race to the bottom. And if the Bank of Japan, as you mentioned earlier, is devaluing the yen faster than the dollar, then the dollar is going to appear stronger versus the yen. And if the ECB is devaluing and printing more euro faster than the Fed is devaluing and printing dollars, then the dollar is going to appear stronger than the euro. And so therefore, beginning in 2013 or 12, even though we had announced this $1.1 trillion QE3 plan, the dollar actually got stronger and started to rally from down there. The dollar index was in the 70s back in 2011, then all of a sudden it was in the 80s. And then all of a sudden in 2013 and 14, it went from 80 to 100. And it wasn't that, you know, all of a sudden, look, with all these trillions and trillions of dollars that have been flooded in the world, clearly dollars are less valuable. Well, no, they just that the other central banks were devaluing their currency that much faster. And it appeared that the dollar was stronger. All of this high frequency trading that gets out there, again, we're trading derivative instruments. We're not trading the actual thing. We're not actually swapping physical corn, you know, and that kind of stuff to determine a price. We're trading all these derivatives. Therefore, the derivative trading takes a trading cue from a stronger dollar for whatever reason, however you want to interpret it. And then that trickles through and all these commodities, which are priced in dollars, go down in price. And it's just this perversion of the system. You know what? There's certainly an incentive for financial authorities to crack down on commodity prices to keep them in check because they don't want runaway inflation associated with their reckless monetary policies. And so therefore, if you can keep input costs down of hard commodities, well, then you keep that kind of that cost push inflation on the off the table, and therefore prices stay under control. And then you can keep interest rates down if there's no runaway inflation, and the Ponzi just keeps on running. And so I don't know if I've answered, you know, like I said, we could probably talk about this subject for hours. But on one level, that is how commodity prices and precious metals prices have been made to stay stable to flat to down for the last 6 years.
Well, I believe that that's a very good explanation. I hold a view that also says that humans respond to incentives and there's an asymmetry in the market. I truly believe that, and we'll get to gold and silver in a second, that some of the price influencing, if you like that term, or manipulation, whatever term you prefer, that if those same influencing behaviors had been geared to the upside, we would have seen aggressive regulatory enforcement and investigations. But because they were going in air quote time the correct direction, nobody was too interested in looking into that. And traders and computer algorithms being smart, they know which way the wind is blowing and they adjust accordingly. So that's sort of a way of pushing ourselves into this next topic. Of course, we got to get here. So this is sort of, that's the larger umbrella, big monetary experiments. How do you protect yourself? I love hard assets. Gold and silver happen to be the easiest for me. Gold and silver is not one word, two words, gold and silver. I hold them for very different reasons. Gold is my monetary metal and silver is my industrial metal still at this point. I know it could have monetary characteristics again at some point, but for now, it's an awesome monetary story. Let's start with silver because that's the one I'm most personally excited about, particularly at today's prices, which are, what, $1,440 or something like that as we're speaking. Way below the cost of production for a lot of the major silver miners at this point in time. You pull up the World Silver Council's chart of supply and demand balance, and you discover that for the last 10 years, silver's been in a structural shortfall. So I can't find any other commodity out there which shares these characteristics. 10 years structural shortfall, so supplies are getting thin. Exact same price as it was 10 years ago, and which happens to have something ridiculous like 180 days of future mine supply is currently short in the market by the big players, which puts it way above any other commodity you can find. It's almost like it's not just the redheaded stepchild in this story. It's got special attention for punishment by somebody is how I've been seeing it. How do you see it?
Isn't that remarkable, too? I mean, because you've described it perfectly. And anybody can pull up those charts and show the amount of the major players, if you want to call them that, on the COMEX market and the days of production that they're short of silver. And it makes you wonder why? That's a very fun question to debate. You know, it could just be simple profit motive, right? I mean, banks love regular profits. And, you know, that's predictable. That's what they do. You know, you're supposed to borrow short and lend long, you know, and collect the spread and all that kind of stuff. That's how bankers operate with, you know. And if you can run a trading desk where you are consistently hedging, if you will, against your 150 million ounces that you've got in the vault, you can make pretty steady profits, right? And so I think there's a profit motive for the banks in doing it. I think also, though, too, you know, they've got trade groups like the Silver Users Association that love to have very low cost, because if you're a user of silver, if you can keep that input cost low, you know, while you're building your solar panels or, you know, using it for all the other uses that silver has, gosh, if you can keep the silver cost low, your profit margins are wider. Mm-hmm. And it's such a tiny market. I mean, it's a tiny market. I mean, if you've got a billion ounces maybe floating around the world at any given time and a $14 price, that's a $14 billion market. I mean, what's a dollar volume traded in Apple every day, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a tiny little market, so it's easy to do. So all those things combined. And then you got it priced not through the exchange of physical metal, but priced through the exchange of derivatives, you know, that really have no link to physical metal. People are puzzled all the time about how in the world can the ratio of the price of gold to silver be 90 to 1 when historically it's always been anywhere from 10 to 15 to 1 based the amount of, you know, physical silver allegedly in the ground versus physical gold. Well, I'll tell you why it's 90 to 1, because you're not pricing it off of the physical supply anymore. You're pricing it off the supply of these derivative contracts instead. And if anything should tell the, I don't know, precious metal, silver investor, whatever you want to call it, how it demonstrate how perverted this has gotten, it's that gold-silver ratio. That's how perverted the pricing system has gotten. So our expectation, and we continue to wait for it, is a point when all of this leverage, the re-leverage, the re-hypothecated, the unallocated accounts, all this kind of stuff, you know, the alchemy that's been done by the banks to create all these different exposures and forms of exposure to a market rather than the market itself. Once that finally is forced to unwind, that's when things are going to get really interesting. In the meantime, everybody that bought physical gold and silver, myself included, in 2010, 2011, all of that, but the conditions that led me to think that it was the great hedge for where we were going have not changed. In fact, as you and I have discussed, they've only gotten worse. It's only gotten more extreme. But yet, because the price has gone sideways for gold for the last 6 years, or down, you know, whatever it is, 30% from 2011, all of a sudden, you know, yeah, admittedly, there's an opportunity cost for the money that you had in, or the cash you've had in gold and silver over the last 7 or 8 years. But the conditions that led you to buy them have not changed. And so now that we're at that point, like we said, where the tide of confidence in the central bankers is ebbing, we may see a run-up in the dollar price again pretty soon. A dollar, I mean, not other currencies around the world, where the Australian dollar, Canadian dollar, you start to name it, Indian, the rupee, you know, the Turkish lira, whatever, the all-time highs for gold priced in those currencies are being made now. It's just that the dollar price that isn't, well, it'll be the dollar's turn the barrel again soon enough. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that'll keep people in the game. Because that's what I keep trying to do, is keep reiterating that nothing has changed economically, macroeconomically, from a financial system standpoint. And so those reasons that you bought metal in the first place haven't changed either.
Well, very well said. And of course, you do have to track the paper games, and you track them closely. At this point, as of today, which is here May 30th in 2018, what's going on in terms of the COT report for silver? And I know that the way I read it, it suggests that we've gone about as far as we're going to go in this particular slam down. But what do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, we can start with silver. Mm-hmm. It has been in decline since February the 20th, when we were mm-hmm. at $16 an ounce, coming off of about $14 an ounce last fall. At those lows last fall, we saw something historic happen. And this is particular, this is specific. We're talking to this derivative market in New York called the COMEX. Right. We get reports every week from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and the CFTC that once a week they take a snapshot. Everybody has to report their positions, and then they get grouped into categories. And typically, you know, it's the big banks that make the markets and issue the contracts fall into the commercial category. All of the hedge funds, trading funds, all that stuff, they fall into the speculator category. And typically the speculators are long and the banks are short. And that's how this market operates. And you can predict if prices are getting ready to head lower or head higher based on the relative positionings of these two groups. Well, back last fall, for the first time that anybody could ever remember, in silver, the speculators, the hedge funds, were net short, which made many of the banks in these commercials net long. Well, hey, big shock then. The price then rallied from 14 up to 16 as those speculators were squeezed and the banks that were long made profits, right? And then the positions were flipped and then price goes back down. Well, now here we are again. The report that'll come out here on May the 31st is going to show levels of speculator shorting that we haven't seen since last fall. And here price is, again, about where it was last fall. We're ready for another rally. And that's just as, I mean, predictable as rain in May. So here comes the rally. The key then will be how hard do the banks fight to keep that rally contained? Because what they don't want to have then is, you know, now a new series of higher highs and building momentum and building interest in the sector again, because that's what happened in 2010-11. When all of a sudden you kept making these higher highs and more momentum and more headlines and more people interested in it and all that kind of stuff. And it nearly got away from them. So they'll fight us again as they have since 2016 at what we call the 200-week moving average of price, which is around $16.20. They've kept a trend line in place, downward trend line in place near there since September or so of 2016. If we can get through there, then you start getting this kind of virtuous cycle of higher highs. I suspect they'll fight us again pretty hard. But the rally that'll take us back up there is beginning about as you and I speak, based off of that commitment of traders positioning. In gold, though, it's even more, I think, exciting because it's a bigger market. And people recognize gold as a monetary metal, not just you and I, but countries and foreign central banks, which are stacking it at the greatest rate since 1969. 650 metric tons last year. As a matter of fact, they're on pace to exceed that this year. So gold is a more telling signal and more that something we can be even more confident is heading higher. However, since the forced breakdown through a support level of 1525 in April of 2013, gold has been in a sideways range, roughly between about 1150 and 1350. For six freaking years, Chris.
I know.
And it's put everybody to sleep, has let everybody think, well, gold's never going to go up, all that kind of stuff. So we've already seen once this year, price got up to 1360 and was forcibly reversed, regardless of the news coming out of the Fed. You had this contrarian, you know, counterintuitive move back down into the 12s. Well, we're going back up there again. We will be fought again to get through there. But it will break at some point, whether it's the economic tide going out, like I said, the central bankers being exposed, loss of faith and confidence in the central bankers and the dollar, political gridlock in Washington, credit rating downgrades again because of a debt ceiling debate that's going to be quite contentious this summer. All these different things are going to lead to ultimately a breakthrough of this 1360 level. And then you start getting into a virtuous cycle of higher highs where people go, oh, crap, look at this. Gold's breaking out. And then you get the banks on their heels again. And then we're going to be cooking. It looks a lot like, to me, the year 2010. 2010 was a year where you could see the economy was slowing and the Fed was going to have to act. And eventually they did it with QE2 in November of 2010. Well, that whole year prior to that, for the first 7 or 8 months of the year, prices went sideways. In fact, in the summer of 2010, gold went through a 1 month drop of $100. So you could have been dead right about where all this was headed in 2010 and then gotten shaken out right in the summer. Because, oh gosh, I guess everything's going to be fine. And then we went from 1160 to 1420 by the end of the year as QE2 was announced and that kind of stuff. Well, I think that's where we're headed this year. The bond market is telling you that's where we're headed. The Fed is, they're already 50 basis points behind the curve in terms of cutting. They've got to cut 50 basis points off of Fed funds just to reestablish a positive slope to the yield curve. That's coming. And once that gets, you know, people realize that like they did in 2010, that the Fed doesn't have it under control. Wait a second. Oh, holy cow. We're starting to cut rates and talk about QE again. Then gold gets through 1360. You get this virtuous cycle again of higher highs. People start crowding in again. the critical point for gold traders at this point is to try to make this happen before, you know, the proverbial train leaves the station. For just people that are trying to protect their net worth and you know, use gold as wealth insurance, if you haven't added to your stack of physical metal that you hold in a safe, now would be a good time to do it, because otherwise you'll end up chasing two and you'll be like, well, it's up to 1400. I'll wait till it pulls back to 1200 again, like that one guy said on some site. And then it's 1500. You think, well, I'll wait till 1400. Your best strategy is to recognize nothing has changed. All of this now is starting to play out, though it's taken longer to play out than we thought. It's clearly headed in a direction that you and I have discussed. And so therefore, the acquisition of physical precious metal is one of your really few winning moves that you can make. And if you haven't added any since 2013 or 15 or something like that, now would probably be a pretty good time to do it.
Indeed. And we should point out that even a post-divorce Jeff Bezos could take about 12% of his net worth and buy 100% of all the silver on the planet,
yeah,
which is just
right.
A way of saying once the rich get into this story, I need to remind people that the physical supply chain for silver is microscopic in terms
right.
of dollar value. It's just tiny. So you might find yourself saying, wow, silver's just breached $20. I want to get some. And your dealer says, I'd love to accommodate you, but we have a 4-week waiting list. Call me back. And
yeah,
you call
and
back
and $5.
Yeah, and you call back in 4 weeks and it's $30 and you're like, shoot, you know, now
yeah.
it's a 6-week
mm-hmm.
wait. Darn it, you know, and you'll find yourself chasing that way, because we've seen this over and over again in the silver market in particular. It's
right.
tiny.
And there's people out there saying, yeah, I've heard this all before. You guys
yeah.
have been saying this stuff since 14 and 15 and all that kind of stuff. But this truly is now a unique time. We've been waiting for this moment. It looked like it was on us in 16, when all of a sudden there were $11 trillion in negative yielding debt. The German 10-year bund was down at negative 20 basis points, you know, and Brexit and all that kind of stuff. And then that even subsided, and the Fed started talking about rate hikes and balance sheet normalization. Well, anyway, all of that's now coming to an end, and even Brexit's back in the forefront, right? And we're back up to almost $11 trillion in negative yielding debt. All of these factors are now finally combining, and it's that loss of confidence that the central bankers have it under control that'll trickle over into a loss of confidence with the dollar, with all the political discord and everything else. And then all of a sudden, all these commodities, gold and silver included, start to go up. And if you weren't building positions before it happened, like you said, you end up chasing. And that's why people need to take heed of what you and I have been discussing. And now, you know, if you haven't followed through with any of this stuff, you've been waiting for the right time for the last, you know, 6 years. I think right now we really are at the right time.
Oh, fantastic. Very well said. And I know you're running short on time, but I have to squeeze this last one in.
Sure.
I was really surprised Ronan Manley put out this piece where the London LTC market got exposed a little bit, because the LBMA said, hey, we're going to show you some actual volume data. And what surprised me was finding out that physical silver, this is the London OTC market, was, they reported it traded an average of 359 million ounces a day on the London OTC market on each of 5 days during November, where they opened the kimono and said, let's show you a little bit of trading data. Isn't this exciting? My eyes popped. I was like, how is that possible?
Right. Right. Well, it's possible because it's all unallocated metal. Andrew McGuire has told me this before. He's been in the LBMA vaults, and it's as simple as a spray painted or taped blue line on the vault floor, and a forklift comes in and lifts a pallet and just moves it from one side of the blue line to the other. And that sounds preposterous, but he's seen it done. And that's how you do it. You have unallocated metal, and you have this, phony baloney plastic banana derivative market setting the price, and they just swap positions back and forth. But there's very little actually allocated physical metal that ever changes hands. And that's the scam of the whole system. It's set up by the banks. It was put forth in 1975 as a way to divert physical demand. I mean, all those, you know, the WikiLeaks cables are out there now of the plan that was devised in 1974 to do that. You know, the people think gold price manipulation is conspiracy theory. No, it's actually historical fact. It's been managed through physical supply in the 50s. There were massive hearings on Capitol Hill because the U.S. lost 25% of their gold reserves in 2 years. So then they put together the gold pool, which was a collection of the U.S. and seven other countries pledging physical to try to manage price at $35 an ounce, the peg. That finally was blown to smithereens in 68. The run on U.S. gold got so severe that Nixon had to close the gold window in August of 1971, and we've been untethered ever since. And that's when income inequality and wealth inequality began to explode in the U.S. It all traces back to that. So the banks and the central bankers have been able to shunt demand for physical metal by creating all these different derivative and unallocated forms where people think they own gold or they think they've got a claim on gold and come back in 90 days and you can have it. And when all of this, which is exact same parabolic exponential growth of all these claims, is the same way that the debt has blown up the same way, when this all finally comes to an end, the music stops and people show up and say, well, I've got this thing here that says I have 100 ounces of gold. And they say, well, I'm sorry, you don't. You never did. Read the fine print. We'll give you some fiat for it, but you can't have gold. Well, then all of a sudden, then again, the whole scheme is exposed and the price that is then determined and discovered through the actual trading of physical metal, not these phony baloney stuff. Chris, I'm not sure what that price will be because I don't know how many ounces are out there and price is ounces, you know, per unit of currency. I don't know how many ounces will be available, so I can't tell you what that price will be. All I can tell you is it ain't going to be $1,285 an ounce.
I totally agree. And it's just been mysterious to watch a lot of smoke out here because, of course, you know, you can go online and you can find plans for a nuclear bomb easier than you can find out how much fully allocated gold is actually held by central banks. But you have your smoke, right? The Bundesbank says, we'd like some of our gold back. And the Fed says, oh, it's going to be so hard logistically. We don't know how we would get it to you. It's just, I'm like, FedEx tomorrow. I don't know, but whatever. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when that finally gets peeled back. So I can't wait to see that and watch that. I know you got to run, so I'm going to let you go here, but I'm going to let people know they can follow you on Twitter at TF Metals. That's the handle, at TF Metals. And also go to tfmetalsreport.com and tell people about what they can find there and your service.
Well, we factor all this in into the analysis that we do every day. First and foremost, it's a great community. It's people that, you know, from all political stripes and from all around the world that recognize we're all in the same boat. And we try to help each other to understand and prepare and post links and uncover this and that and keep us all informed. What I do on a daily basis, and I mean, for this is a whopping $12 a month, I just tell people what I think the banks are doing and how that's going to impact price. And as you're accumulating metal, you know, if I can save you a buck or two here as you're buying physical gold and silver, it certainly pays for the $12 a month. And so I think there's value there as well. And again, it's all, anybody can find it at tfmetalsreport.com.
Well, thank you so much for that. Thank you for your time and your outlook and your expertise here today. So, Craig, all the best and can't wait to have another discussion in the future.
Thank you, Chris. And please keep doing what you're doing. Your services are invaluable.
Thank you.